Welcome to the Low Carb Island Podcast with your hosts, Derek and Talaine Smith, answering all your questions about a low carb, high fat lifestyle. Hi, and welcome to episode 4 of the Low Carb Island Podcast. I'm Derek.
I'm Talaine.
And we are excited to be back with you with another week. Today's episode was actually recorded last year, and now that we've finally been able to upgrade our equipment and pilot's been born, our life's starting to get a sense of normalcy, we're delighted to be able to share today's episode with you. It is an interview with the brilliant Gary Fettke.
He's an orthopaedic surgeon and senior lecturer of the University of Tasmania.
That's right. He's based out of Launceston, but he is making waves right across the world with some of the research he's doing. So
pretty much one of the biggest names in low carb, high fat you can get.
Yeah.
It's a very exciting interview for us.
There is so much information in today's episode. You're going to want to have a pen and paper. Even though it's only about half an hour, there is a wealth of knowledge in this episode for you. So we will get to that very shortly, but I'm delighted to say that today's episode is brought to you by optimoz.com.au.
It's Australia's best online store to support a ketogenic lifestyle.
That's it. We use so many of the products from this site, including their Primal Collective fats. They've got ghee. They've got ghee also mixed with coconut oil.
Grass-fed.
Yeah, grass-fed ghee. It's beautiful stuff. They've got organic turmeric.
Yep, it's an anti-inflammatory support supplement. It's very popular with people suffering from joint pain, and it's one of the products we use regularly.
That's it, as well as their omega-3 from a sustainable plant source, which is brilliant stuff. They also are the Australian sellers for bulletproof supplements, so your XCT oil, your brain octane.
The vanilla.
Upgraded vanilla.
Which we love in our bulletproof coffees.
It's brilliant stuff, and it really does make a real difference. You'll notice.
It does. The energy levels and your brain function, it helps me no end.
That's it. So we are really excited to have them as a sponsor. That's optimoz.com.au. The link is in the show notes. And if you use the code OptimozLowCarbIsland, you will get 10% off your first order.
Woo-hoo.
With these guys for new customers. So make sure you check them out, optimoz.com.au.
But yeah, it's a product we personally use all the time.
Absolutely. Let's get down to business. Here is our episode with Gary Fettke.
Hey, guys.
Gary Fettke, welcome to the Low Carb Island Podcast. How are you doing?
Very well.
Hi, Gary.
G'day, Talaine.
Now, Gary, I've heard a lot of your talks in the past about the nutritional model of inflammation and the nutritional model of modern disease. Would you like to share a bit of your insights there with our listeners?
I've tried to simplify it down. There's a lot of complex material out there, and you can get way, you know, drowned out in all the noise.
Yes.
And certainly the hundreds or thousands of research articles which are cropping up about how we eat. And a lot of the literature, I think, over time is quite flawed. And when you come to recognise it, most of us can't remember what we ate for breakfast a week ago and the amounts and...
Yes.
So a lot of those things are assumptions and approximations. So what I've done is I've spent a lot of time trying to just get down to the cellular level, what happens in the cells, the biochemistry, and a lot of that you can't, you know, it just comes down to actually testing and coming up with what are the real facts. And in simple terms, I think the best way to describe it is that sugar makes you hungry.
Yes. But
carbohydrates will make you fat,
mm-hmm.
and polyunsaturated oils will make you inflamed and then sick. And so I think that's it. Simple as that. What I'm really saying is that if you eat processed food and you do it regularly and you have increasing amounts of it, which happens in, you know, the modern diet,
yes,
then you are going to become inflamed. And as a result of that, you're going to become sick. And if we avoid processed food and just eat real food and eat, particularly eat it when it's local and seasonal, then we can avoid all of that illness.
Yes. And we're not just talking about obesity or diabetes, but even things like cancer and liver and kidney disease, dementia, they're all sort of based from inflammation. Is that right?
If you go to the root cause of every illness we've got, autoimmune disease, we can throw it in there. We can throw in mental health, children's allergies,
yeah,
cardiovascular disease, and in particular cancer, where a lot of my current research is, inflammation sits underneath it. So if we can actually find out what's actually causing the inflammation in the first place.
Yes.
And find out that there's actually a common theme, and it comes back to what we eat. Then we can look at all disease from a different angle rather than sort of get very reactive and sort of, oh, you've got this condition, so we'll shower you with a whole lot of pills. Try this tablet, try this one.
It's going back to not just treating what someone has, it's finding the cause, isn't
yeah.
it? That's a really important aspect.
Through diet.
We can't afford to keep going the way we are.
Yeah, and fixing it through diet instead of
later on through pharmaceuticals?
Every economic model I look at, looking down the path of our health costs to society, is completely and utterly unsustainable. Whether or not it's Australia or it's the Polynesian Islands where I do some foreign aid work, or US, England, everything is totally out of control from a health dollar aspect. So whatever we're doing at the moment isn't working. We do need to go back and just, you know, reset the clock, go back and work out how to do it differently. And that's what I keep talking about, is that we need to get back to eat real food. And here's the science of eating real food and what it does to the system.
Yes.
And here's the science of eating processed food and junk food. It is bad for us. I mean, it's not surprising, but what my research has been about, what's the biochemistry underneath it? What's actually happening in the cell?
Yes.
What's actually happening in the blood vessel? And then what's actually happening in every organ?
Yeah, there's more and more stories coming out. With prime example, I know with my health, like, it speaks for itself. My blood levels in my liver have stabilized better, my diabetes, and that's all just diet related.
Without medication.
Exactly. Yes. With a lot less medication than I was.
The medication actually hindered and caused other things to come into place. Yeah. I guess the inflammation was already there and the body was already susceptible. But then medication for one thing would trigger another illness, and it just became a vicious cycle.
You know, there was the medication for mental health that gained the weight that led to the diabetes. It was just within 2 years, with medications introduced to fix one problem, I was on 3 or 4 different medications and my health deteriorated.
And that's a common story.
It is. I'm learning that more and more.
It's not that the medical profession is trying to hinder you on it. It's just this whole pathway hasn't actually been taught to us as doctors. It's been left to nutritionists and the naturopaths were way ahead of the medical profession on a lot of this stuff for a long time.
Yes.
In medical education, we're just not given that depth of information.
No, and even our doctors have been so responsive when our blood tests are coming in. We've been so lucky to do them so regularly. They are so responsive to it. They want more information as well. It just shows that they're not educated on it, but it doesn't mean they're not open to it.
I'm finding that the best way of moving this forward is actually that the population are going back to the medical profession and showing them their results of what they're doing.
Yes.
Yeah, we're finding that. That's my argument just there, is my blood test. Every 3 months without fail, I go in and get a full blood count, I get all my tests done, and I just let them speak for themselves.
It's sort of a shame that the education of the medical profession is coming from the community for a change.
Yeah. It is. I suppose it's not a shame. It's a good thing because we are getting a voice. But at the same time, it's scary because I know before I was never someone who thought, I don't know, there's other ways. I just knew my mum said that you do what your doctor tells you. And that was it. I never thought to question anything. I think it's scary as a society that we just accept stuff, but we don't realise that their training and that's limited too, and they're just people.
Well, our training's very much, when you come along with a problem, we try and find a solution.
Yep.
Because that's, in fact, what you demand. You know, the patient actually demands, I want to have this fixed right now.
Yes.
And that's been the traditional medical model for the last 70 or 80 years. And I think when I've been talking about this with a few people recently, traditional medicine, science will come up with something, and then it probably takes 10 to 15 years for the medical community to accept it, and another 10 to 15 years for the public to accept what the medical community are talking about. I'll talk about smoking, for an example. That's a classic example of taking 30 years to change the whole way we think about smoking and then have it legislated that it's no good for us. What's happening with low-carb, healthy fat is that the community are hearing about it. It costs nothing to do. And that's what I say to my patients, look, just do it for 8 weeks and see what happens. You make your own mind up. They then come along to their doctors, and via social media, this spreads out like wildfire.
Yes.
We're now seeing the doctors, including myself, being involved in research to try and work out about this, which is now just coming through in the reverse way of medical education that, you know, certainly that I was raised on. So now we've got the community leading the research and the doctors actually going on to try and prove what they're seeing in front of their eyes.
That's so good.
It's surreal though.
Yeah, but it's fun. Good time. Because what we're propagating doesn't cost anything. You know, there's no pharmaceutical company making some money out of it.
Yeah, there's no selling point for this. There's no gain besides health.
And that's really what I'm trying to advocate, both in my own practice and in the hospital system, which is a bit of an upward battle because it's pretty well stuck in its way.
Yeah. Yep. Well, the current model of nutritional advice we're given and the food pyramid, it's been around for a few decades now, and yet I've heard you say our understanding of how the body processes fructose has only come around, was it 2010?
Yeah, correct. there's been a bit of stuff about fructose around over time, but Luke Tappy described it as one sort of major paper in 2010.
Right.
So our current knowledge of fructose is, in fact, virtually brand new about exactly what it does.
Yeah.
And we're still learning some of its effects, and certainly its effects on the brain and the metabolites of fructose, the breakdown products. But it's effectively everything we're knowing about sugar, which is half fructose and half glucose, is just brand new. So therefore, any paper, I think, that's been written before 2010, which doesn't understand the metabolism of sugar, is in fact flawed. So we just need to restart all of our research, which is starting to happen now.
Yes. And I've seen there's a lot of graphs out there that show the increasing consumption of refined carbohydrates, polyunsaturated oils, sugar, and how that's basically correlated with the increase of all those illnesses we talked about earlier. Is the medical community, do you think, starting to stand back and say, hang on, maybe we have got it wrong, or are they still...
The ones in my local community are, because I keep making a lot of noise.
Yeah.
I keep saying that it's a combination of sugar, particularly fructose, refined carbohydrates and polyunsaturated oils. Each one of them in isolation is not a problem.
Right.
So I'm not actually saying that sugar is toxic. I'm not saying that refined carbohydrates are toxic. And I'm not saying that polyunsaturated oils are toxic. But if you put them together, just like in fireworks, the stuff that's in fireworks individually is not a problem, but if you just get it in the what I call the wrong combination,
it's a perfect storm,
then it's highly explosive.
Yeah
They're reactive
in the amount that we're putting into our systems in society now. That's what's toxic,
because traditionally we would have eaten fruit seasonally, and it would have been in the summertime, we would have been more active, we would have been getting more vitamin D from the sun at the same time, and now it's, you know, on the shelf all year round. Do you find that even in Tasmania, you know, where you've probably got bananas down there?
There's nothing natural about a banana in Tasmania.
No.
Like there's nothing natural about apples in up in Queensland where you guys are.
Exactly.
The stone fruits can't grow up there. You can have apples up in Queensland after they've been vacuumed and treated in gases and then sterilised and put in cold storage for 8 or 10 months. And there's nothing natural about that. I mean, I constantly get questioned about the fruit part of the equation, and I keep saying, if you're trying to lose weight, you need to be eating a maximum of one piece of local seasonal fruit per day.
Right.
And understand that it's going to make you hungry for a few hours. It's okay to have it, just understand that you're going to be hungry.
Right.
And then that's got to play it, you know, play it carefully after that.
Yeah, I get a lot of people who try and they ask for sort of our input, and then when we give it, they say, well, fruit seems to be the most controversial. And I say, well, yes, you can have it. I know for me, I can't with the insulin resistance and the my sugar levels spike dramatically. But if you're going to have it, you are going to feel hungry, and your weight loss, if that's what your aim is, will stall.
Well, we call that cheating around the edges. And even though it's, you know, something that seems nice and treat it like a treat, it is actually something to have small amounts of irregularly.
Yep.
Just imagine you're an animal outside at the moment, and we've got some peaches on our tree outside of my office at the moment. They're not ripe yet. At the moment they get anywhere near ripe, the birds will be in there, the possums will be in there. And as humans, we'd be fighting for that bit of fruit.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's natural eating of fruit.
Yeah.
When you are there and you're waiting just at the right time. There's nothing natural about what you're going to then pick up at the supermarket.
That's such a great example.
And it's a lot of people I know, when before I discovered eating the way I do, I would look at fruit in the same equation as vegetables, and so I didn't really eat vegetables. I ate a lot of fruit and said how healthy I was, even though I was diabetic and my sugar levels were high. I would be eating 4 pieces of fruit at least a day. At least
big fruit salads
The time,
just like me. I that was probably part of my journey, was that I struggled with my weight for 40 years, and I thought I was doing the right thing, eating, you know, good cereals, getting up in the morning, having my low-fat yogurt, piece of fruit, bit of fruit juice, having my fruit and nut muesli, my couple of squares of chocolate, because a bit of chocolate in moderation can't be bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was having 30 teaspoons of sugar when you counted it up. And then by morning tea, I was absolutely ravenous.
Yep.
That was me. I was the same.
But that's everyone, Talaine. You know, that's people thinking they're doing the right thing, following the Australian dietary guidelines, having that carbohydrate and sugar load, and getting into strife.
Mm. Yeah, and that's what people don't realise. It's not so much people who go out and binge eat and it's all just junk food. it's in our everyday eating. The amount of sugar we're consuming just in our normal diet is huge.
Yeah, I remember I'd be at the shops and I'd, you know, go on a little health kick for a while. So instead of grabbing a 600ml Coca-Cola, I'd go down to the juice bar and get myself a big apple and pineapple and orange and whatever juice. And that's all fresh juice. And, you know, this is going to make me healthy. But when you work it out, it is. It's fructose and it's not ideal, especially for someone obese.
Probably had a muesli bar with it.
Oh, well, you've got to have the whole grains.
Whole grains muesli bar, full of honey and agave syrup. And
yeah, it's so weird knowing what we know now if you just go look at items. I remember hearing someone just say you stick to the edges if you have to go into a supermarket, if you can't get everything, you know, fresh produce, etc. Stick to the edges. Those middle aisles are just full of everything but food.
Faux food, yeah.
Still need the middle aisle. That's where the toilet paper is.
That's true. Yeah, I'm not comfortable with the bark.
That's a little bit too primal.
Natural.
Yeah.
People often say, you know, exactly how hardcore are you going at this? And personally, my wife and I go, you know, we're pretty hardcore, but it's about going on a journey and starting to recognize what's processed food, you know, and cutting down your carbs, cutting down your sugar. And then you work it out for yourself.
Ed, that's it. I'm the same. It's a journey. It's the big thing I emphasize. Everyone wants this big, you've got this list, you do this. And I'm like, I've learned over the last 12 months.
Yeah, it's an experiment of one.
Yep.
And that's where it all becomes an individual process. And I don't think you can get that out of a book. You just need to start fiddling around the edges. And certainly early on when I didn't do this as knowing, having all this knowledge, the first thing I did was stop the sugar.
Yes.
Then the polyunsaturated oils, and then the carbohydrate came to me as a far later option. And so every week I'd come home and my wife would say, what are we changing this week, darling? So I've got a new idea.
We'll just give this one a go.
And I still don't have it all worked out.
No.
I think that there's still stuff that I'm learning every week. But I think we're learning a lot more, and all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle are actually slotting together. I'm not hammering pieces into the jigsaw puzzle, which is what I used to do with looking at the old food pyramid.
Yes.
Yep. That's it. And it's a learning thing. Even for people who, as a lot of people know, I was 169 kilos. I'm a food addict. It's been a learning experiment. I have, over the last year, had moments where I've gone off. Just sort of have one of those days. That's part of the journey for me, because my body responds so strongly, mental health-wise, physically, that I learn each time. And those periods got less and less. And it's sort of one of the things I try with the everyday people who are struggling or say, I can't see this being feasible. I'm like, just change aspects and you'll see those changes, and it will motivate you to change something else, and it will just sort of spiral.
And that's the difference of looking at it as a lifestyle instead of a diet.
Yep.
Instead of a short-term fix, then we can go back to eating the same junk that got us in the situation. It's learning and changing to live this way forever in optimum health.
It's about breaking habits.
Yeah.
One of the classic habits I keep saying to people is you do not need to have breakfast, lunch and dinner with a morning tea, afternoon tea and then a supper.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's get back to eating based on our hunger and our needs rather than our perceived needs. And that makes it quite often difficult for families and young kids, because they've sort of got those set times. You go to work and they've got set allocated breaks, and same thing in the schoolyard. So we've got all these pressures upon us as individual and families to try and to break that cycle. And so the most important thing I say to people, you know, along that line is if you understand what is actually happening from a society pressure aspect, then you can start making those choices.
Yeah, it does get easier as you go. I remember the first time when I had breakfast and I realized it was 7 o'clock at night and I was not hungry. Like, I remember the first time that happened, it was like a light bulb moment for me, because I'd read about it happening, but I hadn't got to that point yet. I suppose that's when I really got into ketosis. And that's been a regular thing now. There's not very often you'd catch me having more than two meals a day. And it's not because I advocate for that. It's because my lifestyle, I just don't need it. My body doesn't need it. And I don't eat for the sake of eating, and not because that's something I consciously do. When I'm hungry now, my body definitely lets me know in a healthy way.
Absolutely. I mean, what you start getting in touch with those things again. Once you get sugar and sweetness out of your diet on a regular basis, you can actually, food tastes better.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
And because sugar actually dampens a lot of sensations, it's an overpowering sensation to drive behaviour. I've come to recognise again that food, in fact, drives behaviour. I used to think that people who are overweight were, you know, lazy and slothful. And I'm talking about myself there as well, going, oh, look, you're lazy slob. Why have you put on all this weight?
I used to think it was a weakness. I used to say to myself, you're just weak. You haven't got the willpower. You're not strong enough.
Oh, and diets, you know, like, you know, certain brand name diets will fail over time. You cannot succeed long term with diets. And it seemed that if you do some of those brand name diets and you don't lose weight, then you are seen as a failure.
Yep.
So you're constantly set up to fail. And as you know, if you're diabetic and you are given carbohydrate, you cannot ever possibly control your blood glucose.
No. And then they accuse you that it's your doing while it's actually the food that they're telling you to eat.
And so therefore, if you're constantly being set up to fail, then that adds to all that mental health issues, which you were, you know, partly alluding to. I think partly mental health is related to what we eat and the inflammation associated with the brain, but I think it's also partly related to the fact that you are set up to fail, and that is a really bad influence on your whole mindset.
Oh, it is. Wow. That's a huge aspect of my journey, is one, definitely learning. I 100% believe that what I put into my body impacts how I respond with behavior and so forth. I also believe that a lot of all of those self-worth feelings that I had at failing, as I looked at it over years to the point of getting to the weight I was, played another huge aspect. I didn't like myself. I couldn't be proud of where I was at. And then food it's been less than 12 months has changed that. And it's not until I've got to my 30s has that done such a huge turnabout. And I cannot emphasize on the importance of that enough. I think inflammation, when it came to being diagnosed with things like bipolar and depression and anxiety, it's played a huge part. I'm no longer on any medication for any of those, but I'm more self-aware, so I'm able to monitor. I have those feelings still come back, but I'm self-aware and I'm able to deal with it through counseling. And diet, if I have, say, too much fructose, if I say have too many berries, I respond. It's very obvious to Derek and people around me when that happens.
What you're doing is you're getting in touch with what your body needs again.
Yep.
I've found that some days I go, actually, I think I need protein now.
Yes.
I do that. It's so funny. I do that too.
Sometimes I say, oops, I think I need fat. I think the common one is that I go, oops, I need salt. And if you run into low-carb, healthy fat eating, and particularly as you drift towards nutritional ketosis, which is the very low-carbohydrate aspect, you do need more salt in the diet. And I think you've alluded to previously in podcasts with Jimmy Moore, is that keto flu,
yes.
I think that's actually a salt depletion. And
yeah,
that's actually related to the insulin that, when you have carbohydrate, you need a fair amount of insulin to actually mobilize that and put it into the tissues. Insulin has a salt retaining effect. And so when you actually have less carbohydrate, you then require less insulin. And that lower amount of insulin means you actually need to have a bit more salt in the diet.
Ah, I didn't know that.
That is very interesting.
That is very interesting.
I love hearing the different technical aspects to why these things happen.
Yeah,
instead of just knowing that does work. It's good to hear the why.
It took me about 6 months also to up my salt. I kept hearing about it.
Mm.
It was just, it was another one of those moments of feeling like I was going against everything that I'd been told. And now I use my Himalayan salt in my cooking. I use it after I've cooked. I add it to everything.
Growing up, we always had the salt and pepper on the table, but I'd never add salt to anything. And I think even when I accepted that the healthy fats were good for us, I too didn't think salt was a good thing.
Yep.
It took me a while, but now, you can't stop me. Gary, ketogenic or low-carb, high-fat, low-carb, healthy fat diets, whatever name you want to give them, they've long been used to treat epilepsy and diabetes until the introduction of pharmaceuticals. And we know that ketogenic diets are beneficial for the management of those conditions. Why do you think that's fallen by the wayside, that information, and now we're so happy just to give out the pharmaceuticals?
It's all about convenience. And certainly in the 1950s, convenience food became the norm. Able to go to the shops and fill up your pantry with food that wasn't going to rot within a few days made life a lot easier. So back in the 50s and 60s, adding sugar to food was a great preservative. Taking fiber out of carbohydrate in the grains meant that it improved shelf life. And using polyunsaturated oils instead of the old butter and lards actually drove down production costs. So all of that, you know, was actually seemed like the right thing to do. As we know, that combination of foods is definitely going to work against epilepsy, diabetes, arguably cancer as well. And so when that was introduced, and everyone was eating far more carbohydrate-laden food, it meant, therefore, that the ketogenic diets just really weren't able to be used because most people actually didn't understand them.
Right.
It'd be a matter of being able to control the public a bit better with their management of it. I suppose medication made it easier to monitor.
Well, with medication, you could actually get an instantaneous result.
Yeah.
And going back even a couple of years, it was, and probably still is in most places around the world, it's really, really hard to eat healthy. It's really hard to find local, good, seasonal produce, and we find it hard to find all that material around us at the moment with all modern transportability and communication. So if you go back to the 50s and 60s, you weren't able to get the amounts of food that were readily available in the community. Whereas if you go back to the 20s and the 30s, which were truly periods of certainly out of the big cities, you would have been eating a ketogenic diet 10 months of the year and actually being able to, probably able to do it easier back in the 20s.
Because people were more self-sufficient?
Self-sufficient. They were definitely eating locally, and they didn't have all those
mass-produced,
easily transportable foods that being recommended by the government institutions. But I think that's more of a fact than people talking about conspiracies of pharmaceutical companies and conspiracies of the food industry. I think we're actually the ones to blame.
Yeah.
We, as a community, as a society, embraced convenience food.
That is so true. Gary, thank you so much for your time today on the Low Carb Island podcast. Can you share your links? Where can people find out more information about you and the research you're doing?
Yeah, the website's nofructose.com. Twitter is fructoseno. And at the Gary Science is my Instagram. And then there's Gary Fetke, no fructose, obviously, on the Facebook one.
Thank you so much, Gary. And we'll make sure we share those links in the show notes.
Thank you, Gary.
We'll catch you soon.
Thanks, guys. Keep well. Keep at it. Thank you.
Awesome. There was so much information in that episode.
That was an amazing one. My favorite to date.
Absolutely. Make sure you check back soon, guys. We are going to be uploading episode 5 back to back with this one. So that's an interview with Sam Feltnam from the UK. Make sure you check it out. Please also check out optimoz.com.au. They are sponsoring the Low Carb Island podcast, and they've got some amazing products for Australians that you just can't get elsewhere.
Don't forget the code.
That's it. The promo code is Optimoz Low Carb Island. And we'll put that in the show notes as well at lowcarbisland.com along with the link. Until next time, thank you so much for stopping by.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the Low Carb Island podcast with your hosts Derek and Talaine Smith. We'll be back real soon with another episode. Until then, keep up to date on our Facebook page or check out www.lowcarbisland.com.
It's very yummy and tasty.